From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Edson. Right now, all around the world, kids are crossing borders alone. No parents, no relatives, hundreds of thousands of them. They're part of a wave of millions of people fleeing wars in countries like Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, and gang violence and other dangers in Central America. Our show today is about these children and teenagers, how they find their way, where they're going, and how political debates about immigration and terrorism shape what happens to them when they arrive. We begin in Sweden, a country that for years has been something of a holy grail for asylum seekers. Most war refugees could simply cross the border and get Swedish residency, healthcare, education, language lessons. It's been a point of pride for many Swedes that their country is so welcoming. But in the past year, Sweden has been overwhelmed by the number of people streaming across its borders, in particular, children and teenagers, over 30,000 of them. Reporter Maeve McClanigan traveled to the Swedish city of Malmo. She's a part of a team from the London-based Bureau of Investigative Journalism, our partner for this story. So Maeve, tell us what we're hearing. What is this place?
So Al, this is a transit centre in Malmo, Sweden. It's a place where young unaccompanied asylum-seeking children will come when they first arrive. There were loads of kids there. This is a big group of them playing soccer.
That was a goal.
Malmo's connected to the rest of Europe by a bridge to Denmark. It's been an open door into Sweden. Last year, there were times when more than 400 kids a day were arriving into Malmo.
Did you get to meet any of these kids?
It was hard not to, so I was actually taking a tour of the centre with Tina Rosen, the woman who runs it, and we got interrupted by this kid called Hamid.
Hello!
Ooh, very loud. Hi. Right into the microphone.
And this is currently our youngest boy. You say you're 12, right?
Hamid was short and very thin. He was wearing a T-shirt that was torn at the shoulder. He's from Afghanistan.
He got separated at the border of Turkey and Iran, where they started the shooting. When he heard gunshots and he started running at one direction, and last time he saw his parents was before the gunshots.
Hamid told me he doesn't know what happened to most of his family. His father died before they'd started the journey. He came to Sweden because he'd heard his mum saying that's where they were going, and he thought that once he'd arrived, he'd find her somehow.
His father is dead from before. And his mother is alone with four other children. She's just trying to make it another day.
The Red Cross is trying to find Hamid's mother, but they haven't had any luck yet.
So was he the youngest kid at the centre? I mean, most of these kids are teenagers, right?
He was the youngest when I visited, yeah. Most of them are older, but it can be really hard to tell someone's age just by looking at them. A lot of the people coming over here have no passports or birth certificates to prove their age. And age is important because the country is more generous to kids than to adult refugees. Some politicians believe young adults are lying about their age, pretending to be teenagers, to take advantage of the system. I talked to a politician called Lars Bertil Andersson from the Swedish Democrat Party. He thinks this is a real issue. He says he's worried about social services buckling under the weight of all these new arrivals.
We are closing elderly centres and converting them into refugee centres. We're converting schools, we're converting campgrounds. Really, everything in society right now is being affected by this mass immigration we've experienced.
And it's not just services. People are also worried about security and terrorism, especially after the recent attacks in Paris and Brussels. In Sweden, there's been a strong anti-immigration backlash. Last October, the Swedish Democrat Party that Andersson belongs to posted the addresses of asylum centres, including some specifically for children, on the party's Facebook page. Within a week, 10 centres had been firebombed, although not much is known about who was responsible. Now, those are extreme examples, but because of the widespread concerns in Sweden, the government came under enormous pressure to do something about the tide of immigrants.
We're in the middle of a similar debate here in the US. What did the Swedish government decide to do?
Well, they changed the rules back in November. Instead of getting permanent asylum in Sweden, children will now be given only a temporary one-year stay.
Okay, so what does that mean for these kids?
Well, for starters, when kids cross that bridge from Denmark into Sweden, they'll now have to go through border control. It used to be unmanned. And once they make it into the country, there'll be a lot of uncertainty about their future, because their new home won't be permanent. Their stay will have to be renewed on an ongoing basis.
That's Maeve McClanigan of the London-based Bureau of Investigative Journalism. And when we return, Maeve will tell us the story of a teenager who fled Afghanistan and has been living in the UK for 8 years. And just like the refugees in Sweden, he's in limbo, not sure if he'll be allowed to stay or if he'll be sent back to Afghanistan. That story is coming up next on Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX.
Hey everyone, it's Amy Julia Harris. I'm a reporter with Reveal. A few weeks ago, I told you about serious problems at childcare centers that operate with little to no oversight, thanks to religious exemption laws. But that wasn't the end of the story. This week on RevealNews.org, we're publishing new investigations into how this freedom from regulation can come at a high price for children. We'll look at how hundreds of kids were seriously injured and a few even died in religious daycares around the country. We'll also show how religious facilities get a pass on extreme physical punishments as long as it's justified by scripture, from whipping kids with belts to locking them in closets. You won't want to miss what's coming up. Subscribe to Reveal's newsletter today and get my latest stories delivered to your inbox. Just go to revealnews.org/newsletter. That's revealnews.org/newsletter.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Edson. Our show today is about kids and teenagers who cross borders alone, part of a wave of refugees fleeing war and violence. Over 90,000 unaccompanied minors arrived in Europe last year from countries like Syria, Iraq, and Afghanistan seeking asylum. Our partner on this story, Maeve McClanigan of the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, brings us the story of a young man she's been following for 2 years. He's determined not to go back to his home country of Afghanistan, but after 8 years, he still doesn't know if the British government will let him stay.
Just a few months ago in North London, I went to meet Abdul at a bike shop. That's not his real name. He asked us not to use it because of the precarious situation he's in.
Today I'm going to change one of my tires.
Oh, that's like the...
It's like a...
puncture on your tire, is it?
No, it's not flat.
Abdul looks like a typical cool 20-something Londoner. He has dark jaw-length hair pulled into a man bun, denim shirt, Fitbit watch.
Yeah, the tire has been like a proper scratch, and I can't cycle because it's not safe.
Yeah.
Because normally I cycle fast, it's not safe.
To see Abdul zooming around on his bike in London, he just looks so at home. But there are a lot of politicians in the UK who feel their country is besieged by immigrants.
I'm sorry, we simply can't accept countless millions.
When I have 30% youth unemployment in the north of England.
Because you've got a swarm of people coming across the Mediterranean, but we need to protect our borders.
When ISIS say they want to flood our continent with 500,000 Islamic extremists, they mean it. Indeed, I fear we face a direct threat to our civilization.
Abdul doesn't see himself as a threat to British civilization. He actually sees himself as quite British. He just wants the right to stay in the UK, where he'll be safe. He's scared that if he were sent back to Afghanistan, his life would be in danger.
Hello. How you doing?
Thanks.
Good?
Back at his tiny flat, he makes me a cup of coffee. We're surrounded by best-selling thrillers he's halfway through reading. A Chelsea football team mug. Cuddly toys he's won at fun fairs.
And this one I got in Under Tower 2 years ago.
Abdul pulls up a letter that he wrote last year. The latest in a long line of letters asking for asylum.
Okay, dear sir or madam, I'm writing this letter to explain why I should stay in the UK. I believe I can make positive contribution to this country. In this 7 years that I have been here, I have learned so much.
When Abdul arrived here, he was an illiterate teenager coming from Baghlan province in the north of Afghanistan, a country he no longer considers home.
I've started from zero, no reading or writing at all, and now have made the most of my education, and my dream is to work hard in the country to support myself.
Abdul is trying to navigate a quirk in the UK immigration system that threatens to send young people who've lived here for years back to the countries they fled in the first place. Abdul was just 14 when he set out on the hardest journey of his life. This was around 2008. He says he'd started noticing more and more Taliban activity around his rural village. He had been living with his mum and dad and younger siblings. And one day his dad disappeared.
The reason I left because my dad was a member of the Taliban and he was taken by the government.
As the oldest son, Abdul was next in line in the family to take his dad's place as a Taliban fighter.
They want me to join them to help the country. And my mom didn't want me to do that because my mom already lost someone in her life.
He says she didn't want him to die fighting for the Taliban. The only way out would be to escape. An uncle sold some land and paid a smuggler to get Abdul out of the country. His first stop was Iran, where Abdul says he was pushed around by smugglers and squashed into the trunk of a car with four other people.
Bad people, gangsters, they had guns. They just push us and beat us by their feet to get in so we can fit in.
Then he crossed into Turkey. He was wearing just worn-out sneakers and carrying a small backpack.
We walked to the mountains. That time was cold, it was snowing. The snow was like, you know, it was really deep.
When he reached the Turkish coast, he says the smugglers pushed him into a small rubber boat with about eight other people, all adults, and launched it from the shore towards Greece. The boat sank. Abdul had just a car tire inner tube around his neck to keep him afloat.
In the middle of the sea, and there's dark, and you can't see nothing. You can see the lights of the one country, another country. There were people crying and saying things I could hear, that, oh, what will happen to my kids? And I was scared, and I was like, I was reciting, you know, verses from the Quran and things like that. You ask forgiveness from God, you know, when you know that you're going to die.
But they were rescued by a bigger boat and brought to Greece. Abdul carried on across land until he got to the UK. The journey had taken 3 months. There he immediately put in his asylum claim to the Home Office. That's the department responsible for immigration. Getting asylum isn't as simple as turning up and saying you're scared. You have to show proof that you will be persecuted, and you have to meet certain standards laid out in the Refugee Convention.
I didn't have any paper or documents because I was a village boy, seriously.
But he says he told them the whole story in his interview with the Home Office. Pretty soon after, he got a letter back.
They didn't believe anything about it. They know how my country is. Everybody knows how dangerous is my country. They know the reality, but they're still there. They just don't believe you.
6,000 Afghan children have applied for asylum in the UK in the past decade. But only about 350 have been granted it, according to Home Office records. But rather than be deported, most kids are given something called temporary leave to remain, which means they can stay, but only until they turn 18. That's what happened to Abdul. He was given a bundle of papers he couldn't read and an ID card, and he thought he was set.
I didn't know anything about immigration or asylum or refugee, anything. So I was like, I'm here forever.
As he was so young, Abdul was given a place to stay in a house with a live-in social worker and other asylum-seeking kids. There wasn't time to think about what would happen in 2 or 3 years. He was too busy just trying to get his bearings.
Things were so different for me because I wasn't educated back home. I didn't even know how to write my own name, so it was difficult for me.
He started English classes. He learnt to read and write. Then eventually made it to community college. There his teacher was a woman called Laura Armstrong. She still remembers the first day he walked into her classroom.
He came about 4 weeks late. And I just remember him being quite confident.
Abdul was friendly and a fast learner. His English improved. He bought a bike and became obsessed with zooming around the streets, got into cinema, joined a cricket team and made good friends.
So now I'm going to show you my old photo if I can find. Oh, yeah, here is it.
That's not you.
That's me when I was short. Yeah.
It's a photo from 2010. Abdul is standing in a grassy playing field at his school.
I didn't have no beard at all. Not at all. Not a single hair on my face. I was very skinny. I was happy. Mm-hmm. Was very happy, yeah.
But then, when he was about to turn 18, a letter arrived explaining his leave would soon run out.
You know, when you turn 18 in this country, especially your life change a lot because of the government. So, yeah, I was scared a bit when I turned 18 because I knew there would be some bad news.
The bad news was that because he was legally an adult, he no longer had permission to stay and had to reapply for asylum, which he did. So as the clock struck midnight on his 18th birthday, everything changed. And while he waited to hear the outcome of his case, he was told he must go and sign in every 2 weeks with immigration control. But it was stressful. Every time he went, he was scared he'd be detained. So he stopped going. A year went by and Abdul turned 19. One day he was hanging around waiting for his girlfriend in a dangerous part of town. A police officer spotted Abdul, ran his ID, and found he had skipped some sign-in sessions. The officers bundled Abdul into a police car. And it was then that Laura, his English teacher, got this call out of the blue.
Actually, it was a phone message. And the message went something like, "Miss Laura, I'm in trouble. Can you help me? My phone number's..." And then it just went dead.
She figured out that Abdul was being held in an immigration detention centre, a place he describes as being like prison.
I didn't really know anything about detention, so I just searched online to try and find out what it is or why he might have gone there.
Meanwhile, inside the centre, Abdul says he'd wake up every day not sure what would happen next.
It makes you crazy because you keep thinking, like, what's going to happen, what I'm going to do. You don't know what's going to happen to you.
But Laura came to visit and she was determined to help.
And she started helping me with every single thing I needed.
While he was in detention, he was handed a plane ticket 7 times and told to get ready. He'd be deported soon. Laura helped him find a lawyer and stop every deportation attempt. By the time he got out, after 3 months, they were like family.
I can say she's like my mom, like my sister, my dad and everything, because she cares about me so much like a parent.
But after that, Abdul felt different. Like being returned to Afghanistan was a real possibility. In fact, after a long battle getting data out of the government, I found that in the last 9 years, more than 2,000 people, like Abdul, have been sent back to Afghanistan. 2,000 people who'd arrived in the UK as children, been given temporary permission to stay, studied, learned English, and then were deported after they turned 18. We wanted to put this to the Home Office, the officials in charge of immigration and asylum, but they refused an interview. Instead, they sent a written statement.
The UK government takes its responsibility in asylum cases involving children seriously, and we have a long and proud history of offering sanctuary to those who genuinely need it. It's important that we do all we can to discourage unaccompanied child asylum seekers from making dangerous journeys to reach the UK. Where people establish a genuine need for protection or a well-founded fear of persecution, refuge will be granted.
The Home Office insists that it's safe to return these people. But they don't collect any evidence or information about what happens to them back in Afghanistan. So we did our own research and started talking to experts and people who've been returned and found out the reality was quite different. We heard of people being kidnapped, extorted, recruited by extremists or left homeless. We were able to have a brief conversation with a guy named Khalid in Jalalabad.
Hi, Khalid, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Khalid lived in the UK for 4 years after arriving at 15. Then he was deported after his 18th birthday.
In that day when I returned, it was the worst day in my life.
The worst day of his life. That was 3 years ago.
I wanted to have a good life, yeah, and I was just thinking about future, but, you know, they destroyed my future.
At first, he tried going back to his home village, but he says people were eyeing him with suspicion, and he didn't feel safe. He moved to Jalalabad, and for a long time couldn't find work. He now drives a rickshaw.
Still, I have some problem. My life is not safe.
And actually, the Afghan Minister for Refugees, Saeed Hussein Balkhi, doesn't think it's safe for people like Khalid to come back to Afghanistan either.
To deport those that are not familiar with the conditions and hardship of life here, who don't have job opportunities and are not familiar with the area, I think does not comply with human rights.
Back in London, I asked Abdul about Afghanistan. He knows guys who've been sent back. They didn't last long before fleeing again. And Abdul's not sure how he would survive if he were deported.
I'm scared of the Taliban. And nowadays there's a lot of kidnapping in my country, especially when they find out you came from, Europe country or somewhere. They think that you have a lot of money.
Plus, he's got no family to go back to. The Red Cross has never been able to locate his mother or 4 siblings.
I don't think of him seriously, no. I only think of my mom, but no one else. Because, you know, I don't put them in my mind. If you put them in your mind, it makes you older and it hurts you. So, no.
Abdul wants to build a life here, in London. He's been offered places at 5 different universities, even offered a scholarship to one. He wants to study computing. But he isn't allowed to work, and he can't get the loans he needs to start university, because his asylum status still isn't resolved. Here's Abdul's teacher, Laura, again.
He's been through our education system with us saying to him, choose what you want to do in the future. You can be anything. Do this, do that. Plan for this, plan for that. And we're just saying it's not fair to send him back after all of that.
Last year, a lawyer tried to make that case on behalf of people like Abdul. Tofiq Hussein has been working with refugees from Afghanistan for years, stopping deportations at the last minute.
Our clients are all detained. They're all in immigration removal centres around the UK. So they contact us. They say, look, I'm about to be put on a plane tomorrow, tonight. Can you help me?
Often a client is taken late at night to the cargo terminal of an airport and put on a charter flight.
Well, I remember we were talking to clients who were actually getting on the plane. They still had their mobiles. I remember one case where our client, who was on the plane, and the doors were being locked. He was crying, he was panicked, and we were telling our client, look, we're still on the phone to a judge.
Tofiq did manage to get that client off the plane. But last year, he decided to think bigger, beyond trying to save one person at a time. He and his firm filed a case against the Home Office on behalf of 30 people from Afghanistan. They argued that since attacks there were way up, and 2015 was the most violent year on record for civilian casualties, it was now too dangerous to return anyone to Afghanistan. While the case was pending, there was a reprieve for Abdul, a temporary ban on those removal charter flights. Abdul kept a close eye on the case, aware that if Tofiq won, it could mean a safe future for him. And then a few weeks ago, we got a ruling on the case.
The decision and the judgment by the Court of Appeal is to be handed down tomorrow.
Tomorrow? OK, so by tomorrow morning, we'll know if removals to Afghanistan are stopping or not.
Yes.
I went to the court the next day. The ruling took about 30 seconds to hand down. I went to find Abdul and tell him what had happened.
I've been in the Court of Appeal this morning in the Royal Courts of Justice in the centre of London, and we just found out in the appeal today that the appeal was dismissed, which means that deportations can happen again. I wanted to get your reaction to that.
Fair enough for me. Yeah, fair enough for me, because I'm tired of these things now, you know. It just keep happening, you know, and I knew it's going to happen this. So, yeah, for me, I don't think so. It's something big.
He might be laughing, but Abdul's eyes betrayed real fear. He's been living in the UK for 8 years, but now he's vulnerable again to being deported.
No. You have to ring him.
Just 1 week after the court decision, I go with Abdul to his appointment to check in with immigration. Today could be the day he's detained and then deported. So he's come prepared. He's brought a cell phone with no camera, the only kind that would be allowed in a detention centre, as well as his medical records. Laura came too, and she waits outside as he disappears into the building. She knows there's some chance that she might never see him again.
Yeah, as the time ticks on, every time I look up, look at the faces to see if it's him coming out.
Abdul's been inside for a while now, and Laura is timing it carefully on her watch.
At the back of my mind, I always know that quite possibly at some point, one of these days, one of these times, it will be the time when he gets detained.
Laura strains her eyes towards the door while she stands guard over Abdul's school bag and a new wheel he's just bought for his bike. Finally, the doors open. It's Abdul.
High five.
Great, thank you for waiting.
How do you feel now you're out?
Feel happy for 2 months now.
Yeah, you can relax.
Avery, yeah. My life is only depending for two months.
Right.
Yeah, I have only 2 months hope and 2 months hope, and then it's like restart, new update.
He's happy now, but he can't assume that he'll be allowed to start a life here, still after 8 years. He has another 2 months before he has to check in with immigration again. Abdul has started making plans about what happens if his asylum claim is refused. Maybe he'll make his way to Italy. He has friends who have done it, smuggled yet again in the back of lorries. All Abdul knows is he can't go back to Afghanistan. And for now, there's nothing more he can do but wait for someone else to decide his fate.
That was Maeve McClanigan of the Bureau for Investigative Journalism in London. The wave of kids entering Europe this year has shown no signs of slowing down. Most EU countries now grant unaccompanied minors temporary status instead of permanent residency. A question that Europe has yet to face is what will happen to all of those kids when they grow up? There will be thousands of them. The US is also dealing with a huge tide of child migrants. In some cases, once those kids cross the border, they're locked up, with no idea how long they'll be held. That story next on Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX.
Hey, it's Shoshana Walter from Reveal. If you're listening to this podcast on your iPhone or in iTunes, do us a huge favor. Take 2 seconds right now to give us a rating on the podcast app and tell us what you think of the show, however many stars you think we deserve. It's an incredibly quick way to help us out. If you're in the podcast app, you'll need to navigate over to our main page by searching Reveal and clicking on Reviews to add your rating. Each one counts, so get all your friends and family to give us a rating too. We won't mind. And thanks, as always, for your help and support.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Letson. Now we turn to the United States, where we have our own teen migration crisis. Close to 20,000 unaccompanied migrant kids have been detained at the border with Mexico over the past 4.5 years, and they're still coming. Often, they're fleeing criminal gangs in Central America, and a lot of them may qualify for asylum or some other kind of protection. Adults who are picked up at the border are processed by the Department of Homeland Security, but children are turned over to a different agency, the Office of Refugee Resettlement. Everybody calls it ORR. Now, most kids spend about a month in an ORR shelter, and then they're placed with a relative or another sponsor while they wait for their day in immigration court. The agency has been in hot water recently over a handful of cases where they didn't screen sponsors properly, and children were actually turned over to labor traffickers. And something else has been going on. ORR is locking up a small number of kids in juvenile detention centers, places that look and feel like jails. Kids are held for 2 to 3 months on average, but some are detained for more than 2 years without charges. Tyke Hendricks of public radio station KQED in San Francisco has been following the case of one boy from El Salvador, 16-year-old Pablo Aguilar, who's been locked up for 21 months.
Pablo's mom, Evelyn, steps out of her minivan and into the parking lot of the Yolo County Juvenile Hall in rural Northern California. She, her mother, and a friend from church left Los Angeles at 2 in the morning and took turns driving for 8 hours to get here.
Sale de Los Angeles, de su casa.
Evelyn's 38 years old. She's in a sweatshirt and a ponytail, a little bleary. I ask her about the journey.
Sí, salimos de Los Ángeles a las 2 de la mañana.
She says they don't sleep because of all the anticipation about seeing Pablo. Evelyn's undocumented, so we've agreed not to use her last name. But in spite of her lack of immigration status, she walks right into this jail every 3 weeks to visit her child. She tells me she left El Salvador a decade ago and came to California to earn money to support her 2 sons. She cleans houses for a living. She left the boys in the care of her sister, and all was well until something happened to William that changed everything.
William was 16 when I lost him, the same age Pablo is now. One weekend, my sister called and said she had something bad to tell me. She said, "Look, something happened to William. The gang took him. He was always trying to steer clear of them, but they forced him. They disappeared him. As a mother, I have hope that one day someone will tell me if he's alive or not."
2 years later, Pablo set off from El Salvador to avoid his brother's fate. He had just turned 15 when he crossed the Rio Grande and ended up in the hands of the Border Patrol. That was in June of 2014. He's been locked up ever since. This morning, Evelyn is bringing a batch of family photos for Pablo. She flips through them with me and laughs at a shot someone took of her when she was on the phone with him.
Ah, sí, hablando con él.
Ajá, con mi compañera de trabajo.
Foto de ti hablando por teléfono con Pablo.
Sí.
Evelyn gathers up the things she can take inside the jail, the photographs, her ID, and her Bible. They always start the visit with a prayer.
Hoy, el día de hoy, para Pablo.
Pueden esperar un ratito, ahorita vamos para afuera.
Okay, está muy bien, gracias.
When a guard appears at the door, I ask permission to go in, but the answer is no. So I watch through the plate glass as Evelyn and her mother disappear inside the jail. Pablo's one of tens of thousands of migrant children entrusted to the care of the Office of Refugee Resettlement. In any given year, about 500 to 700 of those kids are held in confinement. Advocates say they become almost invisible. Just down the road from the Yolo County Juvenile Hall is the University of California at Davis. At the law school, Professor Holly Cooper has taken on Pablo's case and a few others. We walk through the immigration law clinic where students are reviewing massive files for each child.
And so those two big fat folders over there, what are those?
These?
Yes. How many inches of paper?
I would say it's like probably 2 feet of paperwork.
Holly has focused much of her career on minors in immigration custody, and she says these kids don't have the legal protections they should. Half of them don't even have a lawyer. And Pablo has been transferred around the country so many times that no one has had a chance to build a case for his release till now.
He's been in McAllen, Texas. He's been in Miami, Florida. He's been in Virginia. And he's been in Portland, Oregon. And now he's out here in California.
The government did appoint a nonprofit advocate to speak up for Pablo's best interest. And 3 times last year, the advocate sent letters arguing that Pablo be released to his mom. But ORR hasn't acted, and Pablo is still locked up.
Without any kind of judicial or third-party oversight, you know, ORR is both the jailer and the person who decides whether the kid is getting out. And that's a really dangerous power dynamic that is developing.
And Holly says that's the crux of the problem. ORR makes decisions about where a child is placed and whether they're released at internal meetings. And the meetings don't include the child, their parent, or their lawyer, if they have one. Carlos Holguin of the Center for Human Rights and Constitutional Law says that means there's no way to know why ORR is holding a kid. He monitors the government's treatment of minors in immigration custody as part of a legal settlement.
There's no opportunity for the juvenile or the proposed custodian to review the evidence that the federal government is relying on to maintain the juvenile in custody. You know, that is something that no child welfare agency in any other part of the country would tolerate. It's always an open and fair procedure where everybody understands what the evidence is and has an ability to contest it.
But the Office of Refugee Resettlement doesn't recognize courts as a place where children can challenge their detention. And officials say the law permits them to confine kids if they behave dangerously or if they're suspected of criminal activity. The upshot is that kids who have not been charged with a crime can be confined in locked group homes or juvenile jails, like the one where Pablo is held. I'm not allowed to see Pablo, but I get an idea of what his life is like by taking a tour of the facility with Brent Cardall. He's the Yolo County probation chief. He takes me in through the sally port, the double set of steel doors locked and unlocked remotely that prevent escape. He shows me the family room, that's where Evelyn visited with her son, and windowless classrooms full of books where Pablo goes to school. Then we step into an empty cell, the kind assigned to Pablo.
There's a stainless steel toilet and sink, a small mirror, a very small window that they can see out of, but it's a lot of concrete, your normal cell-looking type of room.
After 3 months of requesting an interview, I finally get to speak with the person who oversees ORR's unaccompanied children's program, Bobby Gregg.
I am the deputy director for children's services in the Office of Refugee Resettlement.
She says the safety of children is her first priority, and all children are assessed when they first arrive, and every 30 days they're in custody. But because those are internal hearings, we have no idea why kids like Pablo are being locked up.
I'm following the case of a teenager who's been detained by ORR for more than 20 months at this point and has been moved around the country to various facilities. How would it happen that a kid is detained for that long and bounced around like that?
Well, obviously, I can't speak to any particular child, but as I mentioned, for each child, we're making determinations based on the least restrictive setting for that child, taking into consideration that particular child's safety, the safety to the community, as well as the risk of flight.
Holly Cooper says one of the most difficult things for kids in ORR detention is not knowing when they'll be released.
It's an indefinite custody. And when you start telling kids that, you know, you've been recommended release, you know, your parent could come get you, next week you'll be out, tomorrow you'll be out, and it doesn't happen, we've seen that can be very psychologically harmful to the kids.
Holly says lots of kids have been given false hope. Kids like Rafael Armenta. She says for months, the Office of Refugee Resettlement kept suggesting Rafael would be released to await his deportation hearing. Then they backtracked over the holidays.
Friday was New Year's, and they called me. I was on a run, actually, of my New Year's resolution to go running, and I got a call, and I said, you just need to tell me one way or the other. We need to know. He needs to know. He's calling me 8 times a day. And they said, we're denying it.
Then there's another reversal. In February, Rafael is released. I race back to the Yolo County Detention Facility, where he hugs his mom for the first time in 7 months, and they walk out into the parking lot. His cousins greet him with slaps on the back. Rafael tells me he thought he'd never see this day.
I thought this day would never get to come, but it came.
When they told you you were going to get out and then you didn't?
Oh, I have a bad reaction to that.
Tell me about that.
I'll go in the room and just do some, I guess, some inappropriate things, like hit the wall and stuff like that.
Juvenile justice experts say ORR's secure detention may not be intended as a form of punishment, but it is punishing by nature. And Holly says being locked up with no clear end date can lead some kids to harm themselves or even attempt suicide. I asked Bobby Gregg at ORR if she was concerned about the psychological toll of prolonged detention.
We're very mindful that this is a special population with special needs. Having said that, we're also very mindful of our responsibility as their custodian while they're in care to make sure that if we are going to place them with a sponsor, that we feel confident from our background check that this is an appropriate placement.
The afternoon is almost gone when Evelyn comes out of the juvenile hall. After her visit, she tells me Pablo was glad to see her and happy to get the photos. Their faith in God keeps them going, she says, but it's not easy.
I'll be honest. I walk out and part of me is still inside. I want to take him with me. I want so badly to take him with me. I go and half of me leaves, but half of me stays here.
Evelyn will return in 3 weeks' time. She and her mom and her friend from church will drive through the night, 400 miles up the length of California, and she'll keep coming back until the day when she gets to take her one remaining son home with her.
That's Tyke Hendricks with KQED Public Radio. She's the author of a book on the border called The Wind Doesn't Need a Passport, Stories from the U.S.-Mexico Borderlands. The vast majority of kids are not detained at the border like Pablo. They're usually housed in a shelter for a few weeks until they can be placed with sponsors while they await their day in immigration court to make a case for asylum. Anna Tintakalis from KQED has been following a young girl who came to the U.S. from El Salvador about 2 years ago. She's now finding out that crossing the border is just the first step in a long journey.
I first met Jenny Cruz back in 2014 when she was 17 years old. She just made the dangerous journey to the U.S. all by herself with the help of a smuggler. She was lucky. Jenny got here safely. She also had an older sister in California, Yesenia. Federal immigration officials said Jenny could stay with Yesenia, even though she's undocumented, while Jenny's case worked its way through immigration court. The sisters hadn't seen each other in over a decade.
Ay, that's when I felt a huge relief. That's when I started crying, when I saw her. I just hugged her. I said, "Thank God you're here now." To me, she looked the same as when she was a little girl. Her eyes were the same, and I said, "She hasn't changed at all."
Jenny is now trying to fit into her new family in the U.S. She has a 4-year-old nephew, Walter, but Jenny tells me she feels more like his sister. I tag along as they head to the store to buy some bread. Jenny's pulled her long hair back in a ponytail. Walter hops on his Spider-Man scooter. Jenny tells me she's still getting used to feeling safe outside her home. Back in El Salvador, violent gangs had taken control of her neighborhood. Jenny became their sexual target.
They wanted me by force. They wanted to have sex with me. They told me they weren't going to leave me alone until I joined them or lived with them. If you live with gangsters, you're not just with one of them. You're with all of them.
Then one day, the gang members lashed out. Jenny was walking home from school when some of the gang members began following. She ran, and one man pulled out a gun and started shooting. Jenny's sister, Yesenia, says that was the breaking point. She took out all her savings, roughly $6,000, wired the money to Jenny, and she used the cash to pay a smuggler. Yesenia tells me Jenny has nightmares because of all that trauma.
She'll suddenly wake up and say, "He killed me." And I tell her, "No, no, no, nothing has happened to you. You're alive." She doesn't like to sleep with the light off.
Oh, can I borrow the scissor? Can I borrow the pencil? Can I go to the bathroom?
It's a few months later, and Jenny is now going to an American high school. I sit in on one of her classes, an English crash course for immigrant students. She's seated at the front of the class, and it's clear Jenny really likes being here. But she won't be able to graduate by the time she's 18. There's no way she can satisfy all the requirements. That's not on her mind right now. She's just happy she's making new friends.
We all sit in the stairs and eat together, all of my friends. It's our little group. And if one doesn't show up to school, we'll call them on their cell phones and see what's going on.
But Jenny doesn't tell her friends about El Salvador. She says it's just something she doesn't want to share with other people right now. And not too long ago, she got some more bad news. Her mom is taking refuge in a church in El Salvador because of all the violence in their neighborhood. Friends are getting killed. Police can do little to help. All of that weighs heavy on Jenny's mind. Later that night, she gets an unexpected phone call. Her mom managed to borrow a smartphone, and for the first time, they have a live video connection.
Hola, mami. ¿Cómo está, mami? ¿Fue a trabajar?
Jenny bounces up and down on her bed with excitement. I've never seen her with such a big smile.
Bien aquí.
Then she passes the phone to Yesenia, who hasn't seen her mom in 10 years. She begins to cry.
Cuídese, mamá. Oye. Pobrecita, mi viejita, ya está bien.
The past year has been tough on Yesenia, too. She and her husband are struggling to support themselves, their own 4-year-old, and now Jenny. Yesenia cleans houses for a living. Her husband is also undocumented. He's a day laborer. And then there's Jenny's court case.
Dios nos bendiga en el camino.
Today is one of the most important days in Jenny's young life, and she and her sister are holding hands and praying in the middle of their living room. After months of waiting and worrying, they will appear in front of an immigration court judge to find out whether or not Jenny can stay in the U.S. legally.
Yes, I'm really nervous because, God willing, they won't send her away from me. Can you imagine if she goes back again? I'll lose her completely.
Building Jenny's legal case has forced her to deal with a painful secret about her father. It turns out the man who she thought was her dad was not her father at all. This huge revelation came after her lawyer interviewed Yesenia about their family history. She asked if Jenny's dad was still in her life. And the truth is, he took off before Jenny was even born. She had no idea.
She told me the truth, but she never talked to me about this before. That my father wasn't my father. That it was some man I've never even met.
The irony is Jenny now stands a better chance of staying in this country. Because her father is no longer in the picture, she qualifies for what's called special juvenile immigrant status. Young migrants can get this relief if one or both parents abandon them. Now she has to prove that to the judge. At the courthouse, we head to the second floor. Jenny's wearing a black blazer and slacks. She's clutching onto a folder with her documents. The sisters sit down on a long wooden bench and wrap their arms around each other. They're trembling. Then the courtroom doors open, and at this point, I'm told to turn off my recorder. A half hour later, the sisters emerge, and tears start flowing.
All right, so now we have un poquito de paperwork.
Jenny and Yesenia are locked in a tight embrace. Jenny is speechless. Then finally, a smile. The judge finds Jenny's father did in fact abandon her, clearing the way for her to stay in this country legally. It's been 2 years since I first started following Jenny. She's almost 19 now, and she looks a lot more grown up. She's wearing makeup, pink lipstick today, and her once long black hair is now shorter and reddish brown. One of the biggest things in her life right now, she's driving.
Ese es mi carro.
Are you a good driver or a bad driver?
Manejo bien, good. Good driver.
Jenny beams with pride. She never thought she'd learn to drive a car and says now she feels like a real American teenager. Despite this new sense of freedom, Jenny has been dealing with some unexpected setbacks. Her sister had a new baby, then suffered a minor stroke. She's been in the hospital for weeks. Jenny's had to step in as mom, taking care of the new baby, feeding him, and changing diapers. Jenny has put school on hold for now and found a job cleaning hotel rooms to pay the bills. But her plan is to go back someday. She dreams of becoming a nurse. Jenny realizes she's extremely lucky to be in this country legally and says in the end, all she wants is to have a simple life, a life free from all the trauma of the past.
It was traumatic, but I can't be thinking about that all the time. I have to leave the bad stuff behind and take the good things with me. The past is the past. I have to live in the present to enjoy my future. Para tener un buen futuro.
That story was from Anna Tintakalis of KQED. She's based in Sacramento. All of these children we've met, they're all collateral damage of the decisions that adults make. They have to navigate battlefields, smugglers, and bureaucracies just to get away from war and violence. We can have political debates about immigration and terrorism all day, but it doesn't change the fact that many of the people we're debating about are the most vulnerable. They're kids, and all they want is a safe place to call home. Laura Starczewski was the lead producer on today's show. Taki Telenidis was the show's editor. Special thanks to our partners at KQED and the Bureau of Investigative Journalism. We got editorial help from Rachel Olroyd, and our sound design team is the Wonder Twins, my man, Jay Breezy, Mr. Jim Briggs, and Claire C. Note Mullen. Our editor-in-chief is Amy Pyle, and Krista Scharfenberg is our head of studio. Suzanne Reber is Reveal's executive editor. Our executive producer is Kevin Sullivan. Our theme music is by Camarado, Lightning. Support for Reveal is provided by the Reva and David Logan Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the Ethics and Excellence in Journalism Foundation. Reveal is a co-production of the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. I'm Al Letson, and remember, there is always more to the story.